Hi, this is David Wilner. We haven't been on the air for quite a while, but what we have today is worth listening to. Stay tuned for another edition of Landmines. So we're talking with archaeologist Benjamin Storchan. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
And he has recently been part of an excavation team from the Israel Antiquities Authority, who has been excavating a new mikvah recently discovered in Jerusalem. Benjamin, welcome to the Landmine Show.
Thank you so much.
So what can you tell us about this new discovery?
Excavations in the Kiryat Menachem neighborhood started actually 6 years ago now. There was an archaeological survey, if near all, government projects go through the Israeli Antiquities Authority, who determine how to go about building and what the building process will be, at least to get involved to make sure there are no remains. In 2006, a colleague named Anna Iris Rose conducted the survey along the proposed roadway, and she discovered a number of areas of interest where there might be archaeological remains, which brings us to 2010, where another colleague, Ron Levy, started to excavate what was originally thought to be a water cistern. But during the excavation, the water cistern was exposed seems from the side, there was an earlier entrance that had been blocked up. As soon as he removed the blockage, he found a number of hewn staircase that leads down into the water cistern, which was then reinterpreted not as a water cistern but as a mikveh.
Okay, so what were the clues that gave it away as being a mikveh as opposed to a water cistern?
There are a number of defining features of a mikveh. We can look to the halacha, the Jewish law, what size of bath it would need to be, the stairways. There are a number of typologies that could be representative of a mikveh. I think there's a Mishnah that says Sheva Madrigot. There are seven stairs. Time and time again, throughout Yerushalayim, excavations in Qumran and throughout the Dead Sea area, mikvahs have been found to have sometimes more, sometimes less stairways. There are other indicative features that a mikvah would have. Sometimes there would be a partition where the spiritually impure would enter the pool on one side, be pure inside the pool, and walk up on the opposite side of the barrier. At our site, there was no remains of such a barrier, and in fact, it seems that only one person at a time could.
There isn't really room for two people to go in parallel down that set of stairs.
Which is not necessarily a halachic problem. Stone, the bedrock, if the stairs are from bedrock, even if somebody who was completely impure were to touch it, the bedrock remains pure. So if they were to walk back up it, the stairs, they would never have got impurity on the way up. At our site, the location, sort of water cisterns are meant to collect rainwater. So the difference in the mikveh and a water cistern, In a way, there's an archaeological debate. There are some scholars who say that we need to reinterpret sort of how we see every single water cistern with stairs is not necessarily a mikveh. Sometimes the plaster can help to tell us not necessarily just the date, but the use.
That's a very interesting point. I've never heard that before. How would the plaster
when I'd mentioned the sort of partition, and sometimes you see the negative imprint of the plaster. There's, if you see modern plaster, it may not maybe just a water cistern. Whereas there are people who work and specialize on ancient types of plaster, and through the periods, you can sort of get a chronology. Some periods they used more white, sometimes they added inclusions of intentionally grinded pottery as an inclusion into the sort of mix, the plaster mix. So often the dates can tell if you have very late plaster. There aren't many mikvahs from the Byzantine period. There are, interestingly enough, are very few examples, if any. I'm not such an expert in this field, but maybe or maybe not during the First Temple period, there are mikvahs. Maybe I'm more expert to tell. I have a little more to share on that. But generally speaking, Iron Age sites or First Temple period sites are lacking in these sort of ritual baths.
Okay, so...
During the Second Temple, we see the opposite. During the Second Temple period, all over Yerushalayim and the surrounding area, definitely in the Shvelah, you see...
an explosion of mikvot.
Exactly.
Right.
All over the place. Wherever there's a village, some villages even have personal mikvahs, excavations done at Shu'afat, famous excavations from a few years ago, where a village that survived basically between the two revolts, the Great Revolt and the Bar Kokhba Revolt, nearly every house had its own bath. Mikvah, when I say bath.
Right. Certainly in the area around Jerusalem. Do we find that also in the Second Temple period in the north?
There are. It seems, I think it's safe to say there's less, but there's definitely something happening that didn't happen before. There are more mikvot than before. In Yerushalayim, it seems to be everywhere you go. The whole Ophel area, south of the Temple Mount, is full of them. The excavations in the old city, the Jewish quarter, over also the homes of the Kohanim, each one of them seems to have their own bath. I know around Yerushalayim that to be true. In the north, I'm not so sure.
So we have a characteristic feature of the Second Temple period that there are many ritual baths, many ritual mikvaot, and that seems to typify this period. Is that something that we could say about the whole Second Temple period, or is it a particular part of the Second Temple period?
It's
a long period.
It is a long period. It seems to definitely begin in the Hashmonai period. And
the time of the Maccabees, the Hasmonean period.
Right, and it seems definitely to continue straight through up until the Roman conquest, the Churban HaBayit, the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 by the 10th Legion. Excavations that were conducted by Dr. Ron Bairi by the Crown Plaza Hotel in Yerushalayim uncovered a pottery workshop that spans basically from the Hashmonai period, the Maccabean period, all the way to the destruction, the 10th Legion. In fact, the 10th Legion takes over the workshop, and contrary to public belief, it seems like they returned the Jewish pottery worksmen to the site.
Mm-hmm.
We know this by the mikvahs. The mikvahs that were there pre-Roman seem to be abandoned and then rebuilt after 70 CE, when apparently the Roman army put a ban on Jews from living around the area of Yerushalayim. But it seems that at the pottery workshop, they put them back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, we'll have to wait for the final report. See what the excavators there, but at least by word of mouth, this is my general understanding, which is an interesting topic on its own. Mm-hmm. You have a group of people. You could ask, why would there be a mikveh where I was digging? We're not inside the city. We're in sort of an agricultural area.
Now you're taking my job away. No, it's, go ahead. No, right. It's the right question. Go ahead.
So it seems that at the workshops there and throughout the entire agricultural hinterland of Yerushalayim, also are making mikvaot and worried about spiritual impurity. As I had mentioned to somebody earlier, it didn't matter how many times you were ritually immersing yourself in Yerushalayim if you were drinking wine that was made from somebody who had impurities. Every single activity was done to the highest degree of spiritual purity. The ceramic workshops, also they were worried about making pottery that would become spiritually impure. And the impurities would be then sold in the market in Yerushalayim, and if a Kohen would use these sort of kalim, then maybe it would...
Vessels, right.
It would be passed on, down the line.
Right. Okay, so we have a mikveh in an area outside of ancient Jerusalem, and this mikveh is distinguished by a number of unique features. Can you talk about those unique features?
Yes. After Ron Levi had excavated, who had opened the mikveh, one of the things he noticed is at the join between the wall of the mikveh and the ceiling, there were three holes carved into the join, two at each corner and one in the center. He, at the time, said there's probably something more to this story, and we need further excavation above to uncover it, which is where I come in. We had started to pull back the earth, and exactly as he had thought, the three holes lead to hewn channels connecting to smaller pits, collection pits.
Now, just to describe for the listeners, we're talking about a cave set inside the mountain, which is hollowed out as a pool with steps leading down to it from the side of the mountain. On top of the bedrock above the roof of the cave, there are three collection pits with channels running through them that empty into this pool.
Correct. Within each of the pits, there were numerous layers of plaster. As I had said, there are people who specialize in plaster, and so one of the questions we asked is what date is this a later edition? Is this an earlier edition? The plaster that lines the pits seems to fall within the early Baicheni period.
The Second Temple period.
And while excavating the fill, they were exposed for 2,000 years. They had filled in with dirt at the base of the pit. We, in the easternmost pit, we uncovered two nearly complete storage jars that also date to the Second Temple period.
Okay, do we know when in the Second Temple period?
I'm not yet. I need to ask a ceramic expert. Sometimes the very fine differences between the way the lip bends on these type of jars can tell a lot. Sometimes it doesn't tell anything.
Right.
To give them a specific
pottery can be used over a long period of time, as you were saying earlier.
And potters, there's no laws. The potters who made these things was also kind of a factory. They just kind of hammered them out one after another and followed general forms. This is how we, as archaeologists, date most sites. Through my experience of talking to non-specialists, often they ask about carbon dating. Most sites, contrary to public belief, are dated through ceramics alone. The best dates obviously come from multifaceted evidence. coins, glass, pottery. We have typologies for all of them. But when you combine them and they all sort of agree with it at the same time, you can really date a site. The more proofs an archaeologist can bring, more lines of evidence, the stronger his case can be. So at our site, which is generally typical of most agricultural sites, you don't have a lot to work with. Again, archaeology is a scientific removal of ancient garbage. what they left behind is what we have to go on.
We're not. That's not going to be the title of your book, okay?
No.
Yeah.
No. In rural areas, often the people don't have much. And when you're not dealing with a habitation area, there's a lack of buildup of all kinds of daily goods. When people go out to work, they have less garbage. When they live somewhere for a set amount of time, things stay and things break here and there and get thrown around. Things collapse and get rebuilt. So usually in a domestic setting, you have a lot more lines of evidence, more types of remains. I had mentioned the plaster. So we basically are dealing with the ceramics and the plaster as lines of evidence. There were no coins. There were no glass finds that were found, which help us to date it. And I'm pretty secure on the date. Ceramics usually don't travel very far, and especially near complete vessels. So what was thrown into the pit when it went out of use, when they decided they no longer needed the mikveh, somebody at some point or another got rid of two jars that they no longer needed.
Right. So that gives us kind of a late date. It doesn't tell us the earliest date.
Correct. And the earliest date is more. So we have in the same line of reasoning, I have the latest pottery that was thrown in, and before that there was assumably water in it. So the latest, I mentioned there were numerous layers of plaster. So mm-hmm. We have now the stratigraphy, or the occupational
phases of the
phases site. Of plastering.
Right.
So we had knocked through every single layer and started to collect them. We have samples from each layer.
So how many layers are we talking about?
Six or seven.
Six. That means that this pool, this bath, was replastered many times and was used over an extended period.
The collection bath. The collection...
So it's not true about the mikveh itself. It's only true about the collection pools.
Right. So the mikveh itself, within the big pool, it seems in modern times, local inhabitants had noticed the cave, and as I mentioned, the stairway was blocked, and they had completely turned it into a water cistern, which, turning it into the water cistern, they removed all layers of plaster and put a layer of cement, modern-day cement, inside.
And when do we think that? When do we think that occurred?
In the last 100 or so years, nearby the site, there was an Arab village, possibly inhabitants there. I had talked to local residents in the area that remember the pit, and they even said every year, fill up with water, and they just drink with it, but they had saw it in the last 50 years fill up with water.
Mm-hmm.
So as a water cistern, it survived pretty much till today.
I mean, it's astonishing when you think about it.
Yeah. I was once with a tour guide when I first came to Israel, and he had said, literally everywhere you walk, there's a story here. If only the stones could talk. And so my job as an archaeologist to make those stones talk.
Right? No, that's right. That's actually a very nice metaphor for what an archaeologist does. I like that. Let me tell you, I was a little surprised. You know, I've been to many archaeological excavations, and I've met all kinds of archaeologists of every ethnic group and stripe, And I have to tell you that I went to see a mikveh, and I was a little surprised to see not just an archaeologist who's wearing a kippah. We have a lot. We really do have a lot of those, but with a beard and his tzitzis out, and obviously not your average run of the mill archaeologist that works for the Israel Antiquities Authority. Maybe give the listeners a sense of how you got interested, how you got involved with what you're doing, and your background, and how you find that each one complements the other.
Uh-huh. I grew up in around Detroit, Michigan, suburbs of Detroit, Michigan, and went to Jewish Hebrew school up until high school, and I was always fascinated. Remember to this day, one of the things that moved me is I had a book of prophets, the Nevi'im, and on the cover had a picture of David's citadel. And this was an image that was in my head up until I was 16. And then I came to Israel at 16 for the first time, and I finally made it to Jerusalem, and we started our tour at the Old City. And there was the image that I had on my Nevi'im, my book of prophets from when I was a kid. And I saw the tower in front of me and the tour guide. We walked into the Old City. We walked into the David Citadel. And he told me, that tower is a mosque. I said, what? He said, yeah, it's a later addition to the complex. It was when it was turned into a mosque, and I said, wow, this image that I had my whole life sort of, but it didn't ruin what I thought about Yerushalayim or my religious beliefs. It made me all the more interested. And I said, so, okay. So I really started to say, okay, I want to see what I really can see.
You can't judge a book by its cover.
Exactly. How true. So I've always was fascinated with the past. In fact, I never really thought I could be an archaeologist. But I was always fascinated. Not only when I would go to the Kotel, I was awed by the spiritual side, but also the physical side. Holding the stones, and you're really touching a page of history. I'd gone to my first year of university at Ben Gurion University in Be'er Sheva. There I met my first archaeological professor, Dr. Steve Rosen, who's a stone tools expert. And I said, how cool, it's so amazing, this day. I want to get involved. He said, so come to the laboratory, you'll help us categorize some of the finds from an excavation. So I had gone to the laboratory one day. This is all extracurricular after studying. And I went into the laboratory, and I saw a whole bunch of pottery and pots, ancient pots laying around, and jars. And I said, why isn't this in a museum? I said, this is our profession is like working in a museum. And that sort of reignited my passion for sort of a hands-on learner. With archaeology, we get the privilege of being the ones who can deal with this stuff every day. It's also an exciting field. What really, so I went back to I continued my bachelor's degree at Michigan State University. There, they didn't have so much of a Middle Eastern or Israeli biblical archaeological program. So I sort of made my own way and convinced them that I needed to go to Israel every summer to go to some of the more famous digs they excavated in Megiddo and Tel Rehov. But to me, as a religious Jew, to come here and to be able to not just touch our past in my daily prayers and my daily spiritual life, through my physical actions, I can literally turn the pages of the Bible with a pickaxe and a brush. And from the, you can really have a much greater understanding. And I know a few archaeologists, and many of them here, we excavated a mikveh. The first thing that when you excavate a mikveh isn't always what other mikvahs have been discovered. I ran straight to the Mishnah, and I said, I need to find the halachas. And
which is a tractate in the Mishnah. We have a tractate of mikvaot and other places as well that deal with the issues, but that this is a very, very specific area of Jewish law that the average person is not generally exposed to. But when a community or when a rabbi of a community has to build a mikvah where there wasn't one before, suddenly it becomes important. And also here in archaeology, right, to be able to understand and fit in what the Mishnah is talking about with what you have there can be a little bit challenging.
Sure. So sometimes people are people, and all the time people are people. And sometimes the letter of the law is one way, or what we think it is, but sometimes it was a little bit different in their daily lives. You know, they did the best they could. And sometimes you see that, what seems to be written in stone, when you look at, I'm trying to find a good example. Sometimes there's we found examples of pots. And as I mentioned, the potter sort of turns them out one after another. But every so often, he makes a mistake. And instead of throwing it away, he sort of bends the rules a little bit and makes the pot a little bit different. And that sometimes puts an archaeological speed bump. But people are people. And so that also needs to be taken into consideration. But here, generally, as a rule, there are numerous times over and over and over, and the best biblical archaeologists or classic archaeologists are ones who know halacha. Or Jewish law, or quotes from the Bible. When Eilat Mazan began to look for King David's palace, she said, okay, where to look for King David's palace? We'll start to look at what's written about it. And that often gives the reading of the Torah, the reading of the Tanakh, an extra fine-tooth comb that people may or may not have.
I always found it a little bit strange, and we've dealt with this with some of the archaeologists that we've worked with. And there was one archaeologist, one of Israel's premier archaeologists, who was not a religious man, but was very respectful of the Bible and the Jewish sources. And he had on his staff a religious archaeologist because he knew the Bible and he knew the sources, the Mishnaic and the Talmudic sources, so that he could complement his own knowledge base with someone who had a broader knowledge base. And that he found to be invaluable as he excavated in Israel. And what shocked me was that very often there were many archaeologists who have no knowledge of the Bible, no knowledge of classical or traditional Jewish sources, and they're operating kind of with one hand tied behind their backs. Because if you're a researcher, what you want to do is you want to bring as much of the knowledge base to bear on being able to interpret and understand the finds that you're having. And closing yourself off to one area of research just seems a little bit short-sighted to me.
Sure. As learning archaeology, it's taught as a science. It's a soft science. You need to use scientific method to sort of test yourself and to sort of come with an open-mindedness. Although, there's a sociological side to archaeology, where you're dealing with culture. And often cultural norms can't be explained through logic. The way things seem logical may be against cultural norms.
Of times that are really far back in antiquity.
Absolutely. So ancient cultural norms, but one thing that stands out when doing biblical archaeology in this region is that you have a time capsule of evidence and proofs, and it comes up many times. Today's word for ashlar, cut block stone in Hebrew, is Evan Gazit.
Mm-hmm.
There's, and I think Baba, one of the tractates, Baba Kama or Baba Masiyah, the Talmud-esque. What is the definition of gezit? And it gives the exact measurements of a block that would be called gezit. Some of the things that we see in the Second Temple period are the stone vessels and stone implements. We know that stone does not, when we're talking about mikvahs, it's talking about purity and impurity. Stone vessels would not become spiritually impure. And so around Jerusalem and around areas where Kohanim live, and in fact, where I'm talking to you right now, there's a village north of Pisgat Ze'ev, Chizme, where archaeologists uncovered, I think in 1992, if I'm not mistaken, quarries to make these stone vessels. And you could say, wow, why are they making these stone vessels? But if you don't understand the cultural norms, the cultural necessities, the spiritual ramifications, and here we have the text to prove they're doing this, like mikvahs, they're doing this to keep the population who would serve the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, spiritually pure. Not necessarily just the quarries within the Kohanic neighborhood in the Jewish quarter, which are now is the Jewish quarter of the old city. Complete rooms with whole stone vessel repertoires were found. Basins and bowls and cups and tableware, all carved out of the local limestone.
So Binyamin, if you grew up anything like me, my view of antiquity was shaped to some degree by watching the Flintstones. And I just, for the listeners, to point out that stone vessels in the Mishnaic period, in the Second Temple period, are an oxymoron. They're out of their historical place in time. We wouldn't find ordinarily in other places in the world stone vessels from a developed society. We would only find pottery. We would only find vessels, right, that are made out of more sophisticated materials that are easier to work with and to shape and to mold and to produce in larger quantities. Stone vessels are heavy. They're difficult to create beautifully or to make them in a refined way. And the fact that we find them in this period means you have to explain that. What would possibly be the reason? And what you're saying is exactly right. In other words, there was a ritual, there was a spiritual reason and a spiritual need for vessels that could not become impure.
Correct.
So your point is very well taken. We're coming to the end of our time, and I don't want to keep you too long, but I'd like to ask you, what has been so far to you the most challenging spiritually, religiously, archaeologically, scientifically, right? Challenge that you have met so far in your career as an archaeologist. Maybe there hasn't been anything yet.
I think there's a general assumption there are two sort of teams. I'll start differently. Israeli archaeology began as very Zionistic, very out to prove the Torah. And then it sort of split. Now, the two teams, those who are trying to prove the Bible, and those who are trying to disprove the Bible. Whether or not, we could debate about it, whether or not the trend in Israeli archaeology is now leaning towards the disproving, there are definitely those out there. They try to teach us in the university to always keep an open mind and to be never closed on anything. I see a challenge where a lot of people's agendas are sometimes to disprove. Time and time again, we have the proof. And whether or not we have them, doesn't mean we haven't found them. So a lot of people take the lack of evidence to mean that there isn't. I know, in terms of my spiritual belief, things that have been found or not been found don't sort of knock me down. But there's sort of like a peer pressure amongst my colleagues to sort of sit in one of the two camps. And I try to keep my archaeological head open And I try to keep my spiritual head in the Torah. And the balance between going, you know, balancing between the two camps is sometimes a little bit tricky. But I don't think to this day things that we've proved or disproved really disprove anything. I think there's plenty of lines of evidence that there were Jews that have lived a life that's not far off from the halachic groundwork that was set. Whether there are many archaeologists who've set out throughout archaeological research to sort of find the ancient Hebrews in Egypt and along the Exodus, and each one has their own reason for yes or no. The most limited people are the ones who are for sure about everything.
Right.
The ones who are unsure, and that's kind of what the word Israel means, the one, you know, to wrestle around with things. I don't think it has to go. There are plenty of duality in Jewish life, but that's what makes a spiritual life and not a plain life. Things don't need a one-to-one explanation. And sometimes that's too tricky. But other than that, I think I have both archaeologically grounded reasons for things that I believe and archaeologically and spiritually grounded reasons as well.
Beautifully put. I want to thank you, Binyamin Storchan, for joining us today on the Landmine Show. We hope to get you back in the future as you continue your research and discovery into the history of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Thank you so much for joining us.
In the meantime, as I tell everybody, my life's in ruins.
There you go. Very nice. Beautiful. Okay, thank you so much again.
You're welcome.
All the best. Bye-bye.